KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, Standing Together, Israel's biggest Jewish-Palestinian grassroots movement, is organizing against the war and for a Palestinian state. Sally Abed, one of the group's founders, will explain their vision, their strategy, and their recent actions. Plus, from the archives, Gary Steingart will talk about his hilarious political satire set in the near future, Super Sad True Love Story. But first, one of the greatest political divides in America today is not between rich and poor or black and white. It's between rural and urban. American cities are blue, all of them, even in the red states. Wyoming is the most Republican states, but even in Wyoming, Jackson, Laramie, and Cheyenne vote Democratic. Rural counties pretty much everywhere are deep red. They are Trump country now. So state governments are a battleground, and where Republicans control all of a state government, they go to war against Democratic cities. For that story, we turn to Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of The American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, the place I first learned about red state governments prohibiting blue cities from enacting progressive reforms was Jackson, Mississippi, a couple of years ago after they elected a socialist mayor, Chakwe Lumumba. I thought this was a specific thing to Mississippi and to Lumumba, but it turns out Mississippi is hardly unique, and it wasn't even the first.
No, we saw this in North Carolina, where basically, the city of Charlotte had passed some LGBTQ legislation, which the state legislature, and at that point there was a Republican governor too, just simply, you know, struck down, saying cities can't do this. And then we saw it in Birmingham, Alabama, where again a blue city enacted a higher minimum wage, or actually, Alabama doesn't even have a minimum wage. It's one of five deep South states that has never enacted its own minimum wage law since they're still reeling from 1865. They've yet to adjust, it appears, to that. But, you know, Birmingham, undaunted, went ahead and passed its own minimum wage ordinance. And the state then weighed in and said, passed a law that said cities in Alabama cannot pass minimum wage ordinances. So this sort of set a template, but this has gone kind of viral across the country, where there are Republican state governments and Democratic cities.
I noticed that Charlotte, Birmingham, and Jackson, Mississippi, these are black places. Would you say there's an element of racism in these conflicts?
The short answer is hell yes. And, you know, we see it in any number of ways, particularly because many major cities have black mayors. At the moment, you could just begin with America's three largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, all of which have African-American mayors. So this is, you know, a not uncommon happenstance in major American cities. And where you have a Republican control of state government, there seems to be just a little edge of hostility to that.
The urban-rural divide in politics is not new. Marx, after the 1848 revolutions, wrote in his book, The 18th Brumaire, about what he called rural idiocy. And there's a legal principle going back, I understand, to the 11th century in Germany. City air makes you free. It even has its own Wikipedia entry. Serfs could flee feudal lands for cities, and their former lords couldn't get them back. And it's not only 11th century Germany and 19th century France. Rural-urban conflict also has a pretty long history in the United States.
Oh, sure it does. And if you look at, let's say, 100 years ago to the 1920s, you have a real backlash against cities and immigration, because cities were full of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe who were not Protestant. They were either Catholics or Jews. And so you had legislation essentially ending all immigration from anywhere except Northwest Europe. And you had the rise of the second iteration of the Klan directed against that. It's really structured American politics in the 1920s.
Well, I started with Mississippi, but is Mississippi really the worst place right now for red state preemption of blue cities?
No, I think we have to look to those two stellar governors, Greg Abbott in Texas and Ron DeSantis in Florida, and the war that they and their Republican legislative cohorts are conducting against all the blue cities in their states, the Houstons and the Dallases and Austins and San Antonios and Miamis and Jacksonville. No, they are at the forefront of this.
In the prospect, you report on something in Florida you call the preemption to end all government preemptions. Tell us about that.
This is a law that was passed last year in Florida, which enables any business to bring suit against any municipal ordinance that business can say has a deleterious effect. Then the ordinance, just by virtue of the suit being filed, is immediately suspended, even if the suit later is ruled by a judge to have no merit. But even if it is ruled by the judge to have no merit, the law still is suspended for a further 45 days. Also, there's a neat little provision here that only a business, not an individual or an NGO or whatever, can bring this suit. And that if the business prevails, the municipality must pay its legal expenses up to 50 grand. But if the municipality, the city or the county prevails, it's got to pay its own costs. So this is about as, unbalanced a piece of legislative chutzpah that you could imagine.
I never read about this Florida law until I saw your piece in The Prospect. Does everybody know about this except me?
No. This actually has gotten very little play in national media, and I had to kind of do some deep digging, even in Florida media, to find it. It is so out there that as at least at the time I wrote the piece, several months after the new state law took effect, no one had filed suit under it just because it looked so completely preposterous. But there it lingers in just a sort of Damocles hanging over the most rudimentary notions of justice.
So you say this Florida law isn't the final step, that there's something going on in Texas too.
Well, Texas, began by striking down certain ordinances that were passed in places like Austin on giving workers breaks when the temperature exceeded 100 degrees, striking down rent control. But rather than go ad seriatim, striking down a whole, one municipal ordinance at a time, what Texas did was it passed a law last year that said that cities and counties can pass no laws affecting labor and the environment and finance and a whole series of areas that is in exceeds whatever regulations may exist at the state level. In other words, this isn't simply preemption, it's pre-preemption. It says, don't even go there, don't even think of this. And of course, what this amounts is really the wholesale negation of local government as an institution. If the local government can't pass its own laws unless they are identical to or weaker than the state, who needs a local government? Which is, since the Texas Republicans have concluded they're not going to politically win in the cities, they're just going to abolish the city's right to pass laws of their own.
So the solution here really is for the Democrats to regain control of at least one house of the state legislature or of the governor's mansion in these states.
Absolutely. Now, they also go to court in Texas. A judge struck down that so-called Death Star law that was the pre-preemption law. although it is wending its way to the Texas Supreme Court as we speak. Problem is, you can't just win control of one house or the governor's office to repeal a law. You need a trifecta, just like the Republicans had when they enact the law. So it is ultimately probably more plausible to get a judge to strike down one of these laws than it is in what is largely a red state to win total control of state government.
Harold Meyerson's full report on what he calls the breathtaking legal chutzpah of red states preempting blue cities appears in the current issue of The American Prospect and online at prospect.org. Elsewhere in the news, the Florida Supreme Court this week put abortion rights at the center of the November election in that state. First, they ruled that the state constitution permits the legislature to ban abortion, which they have now done after 6 weeks. In other words, virtually all abortions. And then the same court approved an abortion rights initiative for the November ballot. That initiative is a proposed constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right of abortion, quote, before viability, close quote, which is usually defined as around 24 weeks. Remind us about how abortion rights initiatives have done in state elections since the Supreme Court repealed Roe v. Wade.
They have repeatedly won, no matter how red the state, in Kansas, in Kentucky, in Ohio. There is no majority whatever to support restrictions on abortion. In Florida, it will require 60% of the vote because of what the Florida legislature, which is Republican, has done for that amendment to pass. But it certainly gives supporters of abortion rights and, Democrats and progressives generally a real reason to campaign hard in a state that has largely been conceded to Republicans in the November elections.
There's a new abortion opinion poll that came out last Friday, Axios Ipsos National Poll, asked if people agreed or disagreed with the statement, abortion issues should be managed between a woman and her doctor, not the government. 81% nationwide said yes, and that number included 65% of Republicans, as well as 82% of independents. So Florida Republicans in November will be defending a 6-week ban, which polls around in the 20% level of support. And this isn't the only progressive initiative that's going to be on the Florida ballot in November. They're also going to have a vote on legalizing marijuana. How has that done in recent efforts?
That always passes as well. One of the underlying questions here is whether this, is obviously going to swell turnout in ways that would help the Democrats in general and maybe Joe Biden in particular. Now, in Florida, we've had the experience of voters supporting progressive ballot measures, including raising the minimum wage and restoring the right to vote to felons who have served their time, but still voting for Republican elected officials. So this is no magic carpet enabling a Democrat and Joe Biden in particular to carry Florida next November, but it sure makes it interesting. And we should also point out that one of the major presidential candidates is a registered Republican based in Florida named Trump.
Yes.
And he will surely be asked his position if he ever confronts a living, breathing reporter as distinct from one from Fox News about where he stands on this. So there are interesting twists and turns that lie ahead.
And one other thing that's happening in Florida, there's a Senate election where the current Republican incumbent, Rick Scott, has an approval rating right now of 34%. So the door is also open to Democrats to take that Senate seat. Their person they're running is Debbie McCarsel Powell. The most recent poll I found showed Scott ahead of her 44 to 41, which was within the margin of error. So Florida's going to be pretty interesting in November.
It is. Unfortunately, it's a state where the institutional Democratic Party and even the non-institutional Democratic Party is historically really weak. We'll see if the confluence of these ballot measures gives it more oomph than it has exercised in the last couple of decades.
One last thing, our stock market tip for today. Last week was the initial public offering of the Trump Media and Technology Group. That's the company that owns Trump's Truth Social app. Over its first 2 days, buyers sent the stock up 30%, setting the value of the company at $10 billion. This is more than established corporations like Mattel or Alaska Airlines or Western Union. And of course, the biggest beneficiary was Trump himself, who owns about 60% of Trump Media, which meant he was worth $6 billion more on paper last week. But this week, the company released its 2023 financial information, showed it had revenues of $4 million. That's a long way from $10 billion. And a net loss of $58 million. On this news, the stock plunged 20%, wiping out about $2.3 billion of the money that Trump had on paper. I see that Trump Media is the most shorted stock in America today. I wonder if you would rate Trump Media a buy or a sell at this point.
Today, it's a sell. Last week, it was a buy. I'm more concerned, obviously, with Trump's political stock. I hope to God that's a sell, too.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold. Always great to have you on the show.
And it's always great to be here.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. While Israel continues killing Palestinians in Gaza, an organization of Palestinians and Jews in Israel is working not only for a ceasefire and humanitarian aid and the rebuilding of Gaza, but also for equality and security and social justice for Palestinians and Israelis, and for the establishment of a Palestinian state. That group is Standing Together. It's the biggest Jewish-Palestinian grassroots movement in Israel. We're joined now by one of its leaders, Sally Abed. She's a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and she was recently elected to the Haifa City Council. We reached her today in Haifa. Sally Abed, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Standing Together says at its website, the war in Gaza is a never-ending nightmare, and the current socio-political reality in Israel is unbearable. Nevertheless, you say, we find room for hope. Let's start with the unbearable nightmare part. I assume everybody wants to know at the top what you would do about Hamas right now. What do you tell them?
Okay, John, I think when you want to talk about Hamas, you also not to talk about who needs Hamas and who the extremism on the other side that in many ways have created Hamas through the blockade, through starvation of decades, through oppression of decades. That's what creates extremism. So if you really want to talk about Hamas, we also need to talk about the root cause of extremism and how it can really be created. And that can be linked back to the Israeli policy, to the fact that for the last decade and a half, Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government have exclusively only negotiated with Hamas while completely neglecting and overlooking the PA, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. That was intentional. That was methodological. Now, let's talk about Hamas and what can be done. We need to ask ourselves, did military solutions ever work? And the answer, the very, very, very simple answer is no, never. That never happened. Trillions of dollars were put in the Middle East to eradicate extremism, and that never worked after millions of lives being lost and complete nations being destructed completely. And we know that that didn't work. We still have ethnic apartheid, we have gender apartheid and ethnocracies all across the Middle East. And we need to ask ourselves, when was Hamas the weakest? Hamas was the weakest when the Palestinians had the most prospects for peace. And that was in the 90s. That's when Hamas was the weakest. So if we want to talk about Hamas, we also need to talk about diplomacy. We need to talk about new ideas, allowing new ideas for Palestinians. And to do that, we also need to create a new regime in the Israeli government.
And then outside of Gaza, in Israel and in the occupied West Bank, there is injustice, inequality, suffering, and has been for a long time.
I think when people talk, for me as a Palestinian, you know, and we do work within the Israeli society, we absolutely understand this issue is not simply, it cannot be fragmented. We cannot just talk about, oh, the Israeli society and civil rights and civil equality for the Palestinians in Israel. And then, you know, Gaza is its own thing. And then the West Bank is its own thing. And even the Palestinian diaspora are our own thing. And I think we really need to understand that, you know, it is a holistic idea. And we see different oppression, different forms of oppression of Palestinians. And within Israel, you know, we have 20% Palestinians, and we are the Palestinians that actually experienced the very first military rule of the Israeli government. From 48 until 65, we were under military rule, unlike the West Bank and Gaza, where we're under Jordan and Egypt. And I think our dynamic has completely shifted into, you know, how do you navigate a citizenship, an Israeli citizenship as a Palestinian, and being part of that society and having creating that distance. But of course, I mean, we saw, you know, we see and we are experiencing decades and decades of the systemic discrimination within the state of Israel against the Palestinian citizens. And we also see increased persecution and harassment and incitement against us as the governments have been increasingly becoming more extreme in recent years. And that comes in parallel with also increased politicization of our generation, which have become more political, more Palestinian, more refusing to erase our identity. And I think these are it's a very dangerous recipe. It's a very dangerous recipe, but it usually happens, right? When you oppress more, but you also, we are more than ever connected to the whole world and to our narrative and to our history and to the information around us, but also are more than ever persecuted, and on the other side, more than ever assimilated in the Israeli society. And we speak fluent Hebrew, and we are more educated than ever. And we are, and it's a very complex situation where you have a very nuanced task of how do you create, how do you capitalize on this politicization? How do you capitalize and empower Palestinian leadership in Israel, uncompromised Palestinian leadership, at the same time, one that assumes responsibility over the Israeli public and leads the Israeli public and its marginalized groups and its injustices and inequalities beyond the Palestinians. And I think that's the key, and that's what Standing Together is trying to do.
And Standing Together is not just an idealistic vision of a peaceful future for Israel and Palestine. You are organizers. You have a strategy for change. Tell us a little about that.
We're actually not idealistic at all. We're ideological. We're ideological. We're extremely ideological. We have a very, very deep-rooted ideology of equality and social justice. And we have an ideology of change, a theory of change of how we do it. We acknowledge the hegemony of the Israeli society and the control and the power differential that it has in this situation. And we understand that we need to build the political will within the Israeli public, to build the political will within the Israeli leadership, to actually have the real intention for Palestinian freedom, to end the occupation, to end the military control, and actually have real steps towards peace. And to do that, you need a very deep shift in the Israeli public that right now, and for many decades, in many ways since the establishment of the state, have been told that's not possible. In order for us to be safe, we absolutely need to oppress, incarcerate, control, kill Palestinians. We have to. And I think creating that shift has been almost a mission impossible for many years to imagine that. I do think that October 7th in many ways shattered that conception, or at the least challenged it deeply. And we are at the point where we see ourselves as the social movement that will lead that shift in paradigm. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say that to brag. That's actually it's just important to understand that in order to change reality and change institutionally, politically, socially, culturally, change, shift a society, shift the needle, you need to build a social movement. And that doesn't only require shouting the ugly truth, but actually organizing people, building leaderships, building the political stream and communities on the ground.
I was surprised to see a report in Haaretz that, quote, standing together's message of solidarity in vision of a shared future has been on a constant rise since the war started. So how big is Standing Together right now?
Not big enough, John. but we are definitely growing. I think in many ways we are operating in a vacuum. We're operating in a vacuum, which is helping us. It feels lonely in many ways. We have amazing partners, by the way. There is an amazing shared society, shared civil society ecosystem, but not a social movement that can actually create like the big public movement and can compete with the right wing right now. The right wing has a very vigorous competition right now, you know, and they're competing over the attention of the public with the eternal war solution. That's what's needed, right? Occupy, expel, resettle. That's their solution. And we need to compete back. And I guess luckily we are in a vacuum. I don't know if I would call it luckily. We are at the moment at 5,300 members. However, our base and our support base is tens of thousands of people. And our subscribing newsletter, for example, there's like over 250,000 Israelis, both Palestinian and Jewish, who subscribe to us. And we reach millions on our social media, both here and abroad. So we are definitely growing. We are also pulling with the public. And we see not enough, again, but positive shifts in the Israeli public and how they receive our messaging.
And Standing Together has been doing a lot lately. I saw in the Jerusalem Post that you organized a convoy recently to deliver food supplies to help starving Palestinians in Gaza. Tell us about that and what happened.
So we tried to do a couple of times. We actually called for people to come and donate non-perishables and aid and just things that we can cross over. And it was a convoy of over 40 cars with flags. What's happening in Gaza is not being published. It's not being something that's told to the Israeli public. So we wanted to use that momentum to of course, deliver the very necessary, crucial aid to Gaza, but also create a wave of solidarity within the Israeli public around what's happening and awareness, increase the awareness of what's happening. Unfortunately, the first time we were stopped 10 kilometers before the borders by the Israeli border police. And it was just announced to be a military area, so military controlled area. So we weren't allowed to go in. Like that would have been extremely dangerous. And at the same time, the buses, dozens of buses with hundreds of settlers from the West Bank who travel every day from the West Bank to Gaza, to block the aid is obviously, you know, they have a free pass from the police. they are actually organized by the same minister who is in charge of the police. And we tried again the week after that. We got a little bit closer. We tried to get a little bit. We actually got into some altercations with the settlers. And you could understand that the police did not have any intention to protect us from these settlers who are armed. So we didn't want to put our activists, you know, in jeopardy. The food was sent to the West Bank. Which are currently as well, unfortunately, it's not very surveyed, but there are tens of thousands of families right now who are being collectively punished and not being able to come to Israel to work. They are heavily dependent economically on coming into Israel, and they revoked all of their permission to come. So we see, you know, a wave of unemployment and poverty and food insecurity in the West Bank right now as well. So we sent the food there.
In Israel, you've been organizing what you call solidarity conventions. Tell us about those.
The solidarity convention, it was, you know, the very first reaction of our movement, you know, after October 7th. We understood that we have two main roles. One is to build, to understand how can we build this new alternative idea for the public in Israel and compete over it against the right. But the immediate need that we needed was to de-escalate and create a solidarity, create a space of solidarity, create a space of shared grief and shared future. I think in many ways, one of the most important, powerful things that you can do together, especially if you identify as two peoples that have been in a story, in an endless war, a narrative of zero-sum game, the most powerful thing you can do is to grieve together. Then you can also think together, you can dream together, you can act together. And we created a network of solidarity watches, Jewish-Palestinian solidarity watches across the country, that also led Jewish-Palestinian rallies, solidarity rallies. It was in Palestinian towns, Jewish towns, mixed towns, in mosques, in literally like wedding venues. When we actually started, we weren't allowed to protest. We weren't provided permission. It was illegal. Obviously, now it's different. And now our messaging has escalated. And also our numbers have escalated. We were able to get from hundreds of people at the beginning to, you know, thousands of people right now that are rallying for a ceasefire agreement to stop the destruction and killing and return the hostages home, and obviously for peace and ending the occupation.
I know you've been especially active on college and university campuses. What are the issues there? What do you do to help?
Oh, college campuses are a crucial space. In many ways, with a segregated educational system, you know, for an Arab educational system and then a Hebrew one, we don't meet at all. University is the very first meet of Palestinian and Jewish youth in Israel. And in recent years, in recent two decades, actually, it has been heavily depoliticized while also being taken over by the right, like the student unions, the student institutions, the university institutions. And that was, the depoliticization was almost, you know, intentional, that you would be sanctioned, right? And in recent years, really in the last 5 years, Standing Together has been organizing in student campuses. And we were very lucky to be able to have that platform. And to have those communities already on our campuses to be able to tackle the hostility, the very, very hostile environment that was created on campuses after October 7th. Many students, hundreds of students were expelled from university, were harassed, like physically and verbally on campus, especially visibly Palestinian, you know, Muslim women and men. And it was very difficult. We created a Campus for All, which is a network of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different students across the country. And we create a lot of support groups there, legal support, social work support, but also obviously the leadership necessary to create the safe spaces for us to work. And one exciting thing is that we have been running people for student unions, very, very on the down low, under the radar, with a lot of resistance, and incitement and hate that our students have received on campus. We have been able to elect 14 different student representatives since October 7th on various campuses. 8 of them are Palestinian. That's amazing. And in many ways, we are really getting to a point where we are actually the most represented organized group on Israeli campuses.
Wow, great.
Despite the hardships, sometimes when you're organized in a vacuum, it actually works for you.
And can you tell us a little about your own personal history? You are a Palestinian citizen of Israel. Did you grow up in a political family? Did you learn about activism as a kid from your parents?
Nope. Not at all. I think there are very few political families in Israel, you know, Palestinian political family. And if they are, they were depoliticized at some point. My father actually was quite active with the Communist Party in the 80s. And then he got arrested. And then when he had us and he got a job, he's like, okay, I'm done, you know. Same with my mom. Both of them are government workers. So they like submitted to the conditions. They assimilated completely. And that meant depoliticizing completely. I remember when I first started my activism, they were extremely worried about me, extremely, extremely worried about me. I think it's gotten better. I think they understand my passion for it. It's not even passion, right? It's like, I don't know what else I would do. but in many ways, they also understand, they deeply understand our theory of change. And they see the tangible change that we're making on the ground. And that's, I think, one of the most validating things that have been for me, to see my parents getting politicized and my brothers who like didn't care at all being politicized with me and being, you know, very, very engaged with me in this. It's been very validating to see my personal environment getting convinced of what I do and less scared and more like passionate about it.
Sally Abed of Standing Together. You can learn more at standingtogether.org. Sally, thank you for all your work, and we really need you guys. And thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. We're broadcasting today from the Center for the Study of the Near Future, and our guest is Gary Steingart. He wrote one of my favorite books of the year. It's out now in paperback, Super Sad True Love Story. He wrote two earlier novels, Absurdistan and The Russian Debutante's Handbook. We reached him today in Manhattan. Gary Steingart, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, Super Sad True Love Story is set in the near future when everybody wears a pendant around their neck called an apparat. What does the apparat do?
The apparat, it's a wonderful invention. It ranks everybody. So when I enter, let's say, a bar in downtown Manhattan, immediately everyone knows I'm the 18th ugliest man in the room, but I have the 4th best credit rating and my entire history, everything is broadcast to everybody.
The high net worth individuals are very important and identified through their apparat. And what are politics like in your version of the near future?
Oh, everything's great. There's only one party left in America, and it's called the Bipartisan Party, and it's a rapidly right-wing party. And as you've mentioned, the world is divided into two classes of people. The middle class no longer exists. There's only the high net worth individuals who comprise a very small part of the population. And there's everybody else, also known as LNWI, low net worth individuals.
LNWI, that's us here at KPFK, the low net worth individuals. And the media, tell us about the media in your version of the near future.
Well, the media is pretty much gone in the way we know it. The New York Times, for example, is known as the New York Lifestyle Times, and it basically is a collection of advertisements masquerading as a newspaper. And mostly what people do is they blog or stream about themselves, as they call it. And so everyone has a sponsor, and everyone constantly tries to make a funny newscast about themselves while slipping in the names of their sponsors at all times.
And how do you choose between Fox Liberty Prime and Fox Liberty Ultra?
Yes, those are the two channels left, the last two channels left, very pro-bipartisan party. And there's Fox Liberty Prime, which is sort of like the Fox of our time. And then there's Fox Liberty Ultra, which is beyond anything we've yet encountered.
Okay. And despite bipartisan rule in Washington, all is not well in the land in your version of the near future. There's rumors of trouble in New York Central Park.
Well, one of the horrifying facts is that, unfortunately, bipartisan rule does not bring prosperity to the United States. The country is busy fighting a very losing war in Venezuela. And at the same time, whatever benefits the LNWIs, the low net worth individuals, ever had are gone. And this creates an atmosphere ripe for incitement. And there is a riot that breaks out among the many homeless people who now occupy Central Park. And the National Guard is called in to quell this riot. And that sort of is some of the action in the back of the book. But what really is happening is that as America slowly loses its manufacturing sector, the Chinese and the Norwegians are very powerful in this future, begin to take over the country.
In this world, you have placed our hero, Lenny Abramov. He calls himself your humble diarist. What kind of a guy is your humble diarist, Lenny?
Oh, poor Lenny Abramov. He is one of the defining features of this future is that nobody reads books. And in fact, young people consider them to be very smelly. Lenny, on the other hand, is possibly the last book reader alive in the country, and he has this whole wall of books that he worships. And so he spends most of the novel trying to communicate his love of books to a young woman he's desperately in love with. She's 24 years old to his 39. She just graduated an institution named Elderbird College and has a major in images and a minor in assertiveness. She's, of course, never read a book in her life, and he tries to take her away from the constant online shopping that she performs throughout the book and tries to actually read one or two books to her.
And Lenny is employed, isn't he?
Lenny does have a job. He's not a high net worth individual, but he's working for a company called Posthuman Services.
Posthuman Services.
Mm-hmm. Posthuman Services. And what they think they've developed is a cure for death. It costs only 20 billion or so yuan because the dollar is almost completely worthless. So most people use the yuan as a currency, the Chinese yuan as a currency. So Lenny needs about 20 billion yuan in order to achieve the immortality that he so craves, because his life hasn't been so great, and he would really love to do it all over again, especially with somebody as beautiful as Eunice, the woman he loves.
So you call this indefinite life extension, exclusive immortality assistance for high net worth individuals.
Yeah, wow. It sounds great, doesn't it?
Sounds great. Gary Steingut, your book, Super Sad, True Love Story, opens with our hero, Lenny, returning to the United States after a sojourn in Rome, and in order to get back in, he needs to pay a visit to an office called the American Restoration Authority, and he needs to be interviewed by a figure called Jeffrey Otter. What's the American Restoration Authority, and who is Jeffrey Otter?
The American Restoration Authority is a sort of shadowy organization that controls all aspects of American life, or at least tries to. It's not very competent is the problem. That's why everything is falling apart. The Williamsburg Bridge collapses during the course of the novel, for example. But Jeffrey Otter is the cartoon mascot of the American Restoration Authority, and his job is to interview all people coming back to America to make sure that they still have good bipartisan values and have not been infected by the foreign country in which they've lived.
And the apparat is part of this process. Exactly how does this work? I actually recently returned to the United States from Italy and was kind of half expecting to see Jeffrey Otter, but it was just a normal human being. How does it work in the future?
Well, you know, actually, I have a lot of friends who are foreigners who come to America and are pretty much shocked by the level of malevolence that they face from people in Homeland Security as they pass the very personal questions. So Jeffrey Otter in this book, for example, asks Lenny who he slept with while he's been in Italy for a year, and then he asks him who his friends are, and Lenny answers some Italians, but the Otter mistakenly thinks he says Somalians instead of some Italians, and this creates very huge difficulties for Lenny throughout the book because he constantly thinks that the American Restoration Authority in the guise of Jeffrey Otter is out to get him.
And they also don't, Jeffrey Otter doesn't quite understand that his employer is indefinite life extension. How do they interpret this?
I think it's effeminate life invention.
Yes.
So that creates further problems.
Further problems. So you said our man, Lenny Abramov, is in love with Eunice Park. Tell us about Eunice.
Well, she's a Korean-American. She's 24 years old. And unlike Lenny, she is completely of the digital generation. She has absolutely no interest in any kind of introspection. What she spends most of the time doing is shopping at several stores that have very risque names I probably shouldn't say on the air.
It is the family hour here, so.
It is the family hour, so I probably shouldn't say them, but they are very risque places in which she shops. And then when she sees Lenny, she realizes that he is very misfortunate in being a part of this old analog generation that reads, and she begins to try to give him a kind of makeover, where she dresses him in less flammable fabrics, for example, and tries to make him more like her.
Eunice, the young person, does not read books. Where did you get this idea?
Well, actually, I, like Lenny, I myself am an owner of an entire wall of books in my apartment. It takes up one wall. And a young man, I called up the cable company to repair my cable, and a young man, probably in his early 20s, like Eunice, came up and he said, "Oh man, why you got all them books here?" He was so disgusted by the presence of so many volumes. And then he looked at my television, which was only 25 inches, and he said, "And you only got a 25-inch TV?" And it was very emasculating, he seemed to say, that the size of my TV and the presence of all these books made me less of a human being than other people. And it was, and that's when I realized that, oh my God, you know, I do come from probably the last generation in which books were really loved and cherished, and for younger generations, for many of them, but if not for most of them, books are an impediment or an inconvenience or something that has to be studied at school. Eunice, for example, calls them doorstops, which is actually something I've heard of young people call novels, big novels before.
Eunice, who is 24 years old, you say had a double major. What was her major again?
She majored in images, but she has a minor in assertiveness. So she's really good at shopping because you need to be assertive, especially during sales.
And Eunice does not read, but Eunice writes. She actually writes a lot. Where did you get this idea?
Well, she writes, and actually, you know, to be fair to Eunice, she is one of the smartest people of her generation because she uses complete sentences with a subject and a predicate. Lenny even calls her my reluctant sentence monger because she's always making sentences. So Eunice does have that wonderful side to her. She's still very, despite all the degradations of the future, she is able to speak and write in a way that I think, I hope at least, that as the book goes on, she becomes seen not just as a shallow character because of who she is, but rather a creature of her times. And as the book continues, her sentences, and Lenny sort of opens up her heart a little bit, and she starts to write in a more sympathetic way about all the problems that people normally face. For example, both Lenny and Eunice come from very dysfunctional immigrant families. Lenny from a Russian family, Eunice from a Korean family. And I think that's one of the things that brings them together, despite their many differences, the fact that she's young and beautiful and he's not as young and certainly not as attractive.
Actually, you say that Eunice is, or Lenny says, Eunice is impossibly cute, but Eunice has problems. Why don't you tell us about Eunice's problems?
Well, Eunice has many problems. One of the problems, I think, is that she really is a smart thinking person who grows up surrounded by people who do nothing but care about very superficial things. And the other thing is that her father is very violent and abusive, and she feels like, as the oldest daughter, she has a sister, that she has to protect her sister from her parents. And, of course, she has the problem that every other American character in the book, whether hyphenated or not, will encounter, which is the fact that the whole country is falling apart around them and there aren't any real jobs left and there isn't really any kind of future to pursue other than mindless shopping and hoping that one's credit score is high enough to pursue the genes that one wants.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Gary Steingart about his wonderful new book, Super Sad True Love Story. It's out now in paperback. What does Eunice, the impossibly cute young Korean, see in Lenny, the middle-aged Jewish guy?
The old nebbish routine, you know, everybody loves a nebbish. Well, I think she sees in him, at first she's very much disgusted by him, and they get together in Rome under very drunken circumstances, and she wakes up and she starts texting all her friends and telling them, oh my God, what a mistake I've made. But then, you know, as the novel progresses, she sees that Lenny is one of the only people that actually, in a world where nobody listens to anybody, because one of the things that I think happens when one doesn't, for example, read books, one fails to develop a sense of empathy for others, and one fails to... Everyone in this book is sort of screaming about themselves to one another via their apparats. So I think one thing that Eunice likes about Lenny is the fact that this man has been conditioned to read. He has been conditioned to listen constantly. And so she, as the book continues, she opens up more and more about the difficulties of growing up with a very abusive father, and I think she finds in Lenny finally a person who, despite his many failings, is sympathetic to her.
Gary Steingart, in Super Sad True Love Story, we readers root for Lenny and Eunice. We want them to make it as a couple. It reminds me a little bit of George Orwell's 1984 and the way we root for the lovers Winston and Julia to escape from the thought police. I wonder if this was on your mind when you were writing Lenny and Eunice.
It really was. I mean, I really wanted to make it a dystopian love story, and there aren't too many precedents for that. You think of something like Brave New World. To me, Brave New World was, a better novel of ideas. I mean, a lot of the ideas it had really have come true since Huxley wrote it. But I don't really remember that book because I don't really remember the characters in that book. But I do remember 1984 precisely for the reason you said, because I'm hoping as I'm reading it that Julia and Winston will escape the thought police and that their love will blossom. Now, I think the difference between 1984 and what I was trying to do was the fact in 1984, Big Brother, the surveillance society, is everywhere, and it's constantly looking and trying to monitor these characters. But in Super Sad True Love Story, being based in the 21st century, there's no need for Big Brother anymore because all of us are constantly supplying on Facebook, on Twitter, on every other social media. We're already advertising ourselves and giving up all the information about ourselves so that any totalitarian government, or for that matter, any corporation, can just look up who we are very easily. So we have sort of all become enablers to Big Brother in this book. Mm.
I noticed the Wall Street Journal called Super Sad True Love Story, quote, a funny book about the financial crisis, close quote. I wonder if that's the way you would describe it.
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting idea. It's about the financial crisis in 2006, perhaps in the way that, you know, when I started writing this book, it was in 2006. It was before the financial crisis. But in my original sort of draft of the book, some of the horrible things that were going to happen to America was, well, Lehman Brothers, for example, would fail, and GM and Chrysler would start to go out of business. And by 2008, only 2 years into writing this book, I realized that all this stuff was already happening. So I had to constantly make things worse and worse. And that's one of the difficulties about writing a novel these days, is that there doesn't seem to be a present left for us to write about. Everything is the future. We are constantly living in the future. And that was sort of, as the novel went on, I had to keep that in mind, the fact that, you know, writing a novel is fairly difficult these days because of the time it takes to produce one, whereas, you know, it's much easier to write a blog about something.
And the Village Voice called Super Sad True Love Story, quote, the finest piece of anti-iPhone propaganda ever written, close quote. I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, that's a funny quote, because to research this book, I mean, I was, like Lenny, a fairly analog person, but to research this book, I actually hired an assistant who got me my first iPhone and who got me on Facebook and all these different things as a part of the research process. So it was really interesting to... I myself went from somebody who sort of didn't want to have anything to do with this technology to somebody who became wildly addicted to it, because, let's face it, I mean, this stuff, having an iPhone in the palm of your hand where, you know, the whole world is at your disposal, such as it is it can be pretty addictive. So after finishing this book, I began to try to create strategies for myself for not being online all the time and not having an iPhone with me at all times.
And what are those strategies? This is the news you can use portion of our broadcast.
Well, I am very lucky to live in near upstate New York, the countryside, because in New York, the main provider for the iPhone is AT&T, which is a company that doesn't really know how to connect signals to telephones. So when I go upstate in the countryside, only 2 hours north of Manhattan, there's no reception. So I spend days upon days, being cut off from the world. So my advice is, and hopefully this will work in parts of California as well, is to find an AT&T phone, iPhone, and then go out into the countryside.
Now, you say that it's important to live without the iPhone, and yet you have a Gary Steingart iPhone app.
Yes, but I've never used it, and I don't know how it works. So.
For those who are not subscribers to AT&T, we have a link to the Gary Steingart iPhone app at the website for this show, johnweiner.com. If you're an iPhone user, we invite you to download the Gary Steingart iPhone app and find out what Gary does not know about his own app. I noticed the company that provides the iPhone, the Gary Steingart iPhone app, also has one for Madonna and one for the Miami Dolphins.
That is absolutely incredible. Yes, I didn't know that, but if you figure out, if any listener figures out how to use my app, please go on my Facebook page and tell me. I would love to know.
Well, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We've been speaking with Gary Steingart. His new book, Out in Paperback, is Super Sad True Love Story, one of my favorite books of the year. Gary, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
We spoke with Gary Steingart about Super Sad True Love Story in July 2011. His app is still available at the iPhone App Store. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week, talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.